Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
This podcast is recorded on the lands of the Dja-Dja Wurrung and the Wadawurrung people of the Eastern Kulin Nation, and we wish to acknowledge them as traditional owners. We would also like to pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and Aboriginal elders of other communities who may be listening. And the laboratory. That's that word again.
Laboratory.
Why do I have such a hard time with that?
I know. It's difficult.
Laboratory. I look at it and say Labrador.
Yeah, yep.
Laboratory. So I want to say Labrador, laboratory.
Yep.
Laboratory.
Laboratory. Yeah,
okay. Thank you. Hello and welcome to Chickstory, the podcast that is rewriting the history books to include the women that were written out of them. I'm Annie, and I'm definitely not a historian.
And I'm Phoebe, and I'm an actual historian and the owner of Born and Bred Historical Research.
It's good that you are an actual historian if you do own Born and Bred Historical Research, right?
It's quite helpful, I've got to say.
Oh, so here we are back again for another episode where we are going to tell you all about an amazing woman in history who you probably haven't heard of, but you've probably heard of what she's done or invented, perhaps, especially for this episode, just as a little hint.
Teaser.
Yeah, and we just sit here and we tell you a story and you just listen for the next 20 or so minutes, and that's how it works.
Boom, we're done. Simple as that.
Let's get started. Oh, first of all, what we do is I'm being very descriptive today. Like, okay, now, next, what we do is this thing called.
It's a step-by-step process.
No, each week we have a little segment we called Chick Picks.
You did.
Chick Picks, and I tell you my pick of the week for something that I have been listening to because I love podcasts, and Phoebe will tell us about a book that she has read, not necessarily in the last week, because that would mean that you read a book a week.
I try to read a book a week, but I don't always recommend the books that I read.
Do you stick it out to the end?
No, I used to, because I used to feel really bad. I'm like, someone's put their blood, sweat and tears in this, and good on them, because that's a huge, you know, feat to be able to write a book. But life's also too short to read something you don't enjoy. But that doesn't mean someone else isn't going to enjoy it. It's just not my cup of tea. I read, I would give it, I usually know within sort of the first couple of chapters.
So my podcast recommendation for today is a podcast called Media Pressure. It's about the story of a girl called Maura Murray. She's a young college student who leaves her campus in the wee hours of the morning. She crashes her car and the accident is witnessed. She crashes her car on the side of the road, and then moments later she disappears. She's never been seen again. There are obviously a lot of theories around what happens. It's two decades on and they still haven't, so it still remains unsolved. It's one of America's most widely known true crime mysteries, and the podcast is told by her sister with the support of other family members who are still trying to find answers. Her dad also features in it quite heavily, which is heartbreaking. And it's just, it's one of those podcasts that you just go, what happened to this girl? What happened to this woman? She was there 1 minute and literally gone the next. So give it a listen, Media Pressure.
Thank you. I will. Yeah. I do love a mystery, probably why I do my job.
Yeah.
Like, try and solve mysteries.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it. You literally do that every day.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes I can't. But anyway, let's not get into that. My recommendation this week is a book called Sisters Under the Rising Sun by Heather Morris. Big surprise, this is another historical fiction book. Can you tell that I, you know, there's a genre that I lean towards, and is about women and war. So this story is about bravery and friendship in some of the darkest times. It's based on a true story and real women, and is set during the Second World War when Singapore fell to the Japanese. The story centres around an Australian nurse, along with other women and children, who survived the bombing of their boat off the coast of Indonesia and then were sent to prisoner of war camps where they faced starvation, sickness, death and brutality. This story also in part speaks to some of the heroic tales of Vivian Bullwinkle, a remarkable Australian nurse who we'll have to do an episode on. And part of this story is actually also the premise of a movie called Paradise Road, which was made in 1997. I'm not sure if you've seen it. It's got Glenn Close and Cate Blanchett. There's quite a lot of faces in it that you'd know as well. I think Frances McDormand's in it as well. So Sisters Under the Rising Sun is the fourth book by Heather Morris, who also wrote The Tattooist of Auschwitz, Silke's Journey and Three Sisters, which I would recommend as well. The first, The Tattooist of Auschwitz, has been made into a TV series, which is set to air on Stan from early May. So I'm excited to watch that as well.
Sources for today's Chickstory are Wikipedia. Thanks, Wikipedia. I do actually, I have donated to Wikipedia. I do make sure I do that each year. Yes.
There you go.
They do. I do. Because I use it. I use it a lot for this. And yes, it's not a huge amount, but you just feel good that you like, okay. The Science History Institute and Britannica.com.
Remember Encyclopedia Britannica's on CD-ROMs?
Remember them as books.
Well, as books, but then that. So yes, I also books.
Back in the day, we had this thing called books.
They had the paper and the covers, and they smelt funny. Early computer days, it was just like one CD-ROM though. Yeah, I don't think there's a lot on it.
The entire catalogue?
Yeah, pretty much. Sorry, continue. Right.
I mean, I do remember, every family in the 70s had their collection of their Encyclopedia Britannica, which, you'd pull out if you had to do your project on something.
What is an aardvark? Yes.
Or just China.
Yeah.
The year is 1971, and Apollo 14 is the eighth crewed mission in the United States Apollo program and the third to land on the moon. Walt Disney World Resort opens in Orlando, Florida, and is the second Disney theme park in the world behind Disneyland, which was first opened in 1955. The environmental organization Greenpeace was founded in Vancouver, Canada, and Stephanie Kwolek will invent a material five times stronger than steel that will be used to make the first ever bulletproof vest. Stephanie Louise Kwolek was born on July 31st, 1923, to a family of Polish descent in New Kensington, which is a small town in Pennsylvania. As a young child, she would often sit and watch her mother sewing. Her mother was a seamstress. And she would imitate her mother by drawing patterns and making clothing for paper dolls. When she got a bit older, she went on to making actual clothes from fabric, sneaking onto her mother's sewing machine when she wasn't around. Self-described as a very creative child, her parents encouraged her curiosity and intellect, and her mother encouraged her to go on to a career in fashion design, while her father, who was a naturalist, inspired her interest in the outdoors. They both fostered a love for learning, and that would go on to shape Stephanie's future endeavors. She loved to go wandering with her father, collecting leaves and flowers and creating scrapbooks of her finds. She would then take pride in drying them out and naming them, creating her own catalogue of the plants near her house. Despite the family facing financial challenges, Stephanie excelled academically. The grade school she attended, which was in a small rural town, was small enough to require her classroom to be shared by two different grades, which she absolutely loved. She said it felt like she was learning two grades at once. As her love of science grew, she easily outpaced the older children. She also learned very quickly that you could make the boys very angry if you knew the answer to a maths problem and you spoke up. Something that she found out through experience. She read a lot more than was intended for her grade, and she had a brilliant memory, memorising every page she read. And it's here that her aptitude for science and mathematics became evident, and she knew at this age that she was different. She was inspired by her high school chemistry teacher, and she quickly developed a passion for chemistry and aspired to pursue it further. After graduating from high school in 1942, Stephanie enrolled at the Carnegie Institute of Technology, now the Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, as a chemistry major. Despite encountering initial skepticism from her family about pursuing a career in science, she remained determined. At Carnegie Tech, she immersed herself in her studies, delving into the intricacies of chemistry and materials science. Stephanie's academic pursuits flourished at Carnegie Tech, where she thrived under the mentorship of distinguished chemists. She was heavily influenced by her female lecturer, Dr. Clara Miller, who taught her chemistry. It wasn't lost on Stephanie that this wasn't an easy time for women in academia. And she was surprised that Dr. Miller was as enthusiastic as she was, being surrounded by men, obviously. We're talking the 40s.
I'm surprised she was even there.
Right? Yeah. I know. Absolutely. Me too, when I read that. So during her first year at the University of Pittsburgh, Stephanie was asked to join a panel by the faculty to present her current work. She was very surprised that she was asked, and it was at this point she thought to herself, oh, I must be pretty good. So even though she was great at chemistry, she still had varied thoughts about what she wanted to pursue as a career, and she still often thought about becoming a dress designer, a teacher, or a doctor. In 1946, she graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Chemistry. Still interested in becoming a doctor, she thought she would go out and start earning money, and then she would pursue her dream of becoming a doctor. At the time, so what are we talking, 1946, not many women were being hired within the sciences, but opportunities were becoming more abundant than usual, as most of the men were still at war or coming home from war, which we know was women's time to shine.
Yes. We're only briefly.
So women, only briefly, just for a little while, and then we're going to take it back. Mm. Yeah. So women were being made offers, but usually didn't stay very long, especially women who had PhDs. Many left after a couple of years and went into teaching. But being stubborn, Stephanie decided that she was going to stick it out and see what happened. She had two places in mind that she wanted to work at. One was either the Gulf Research or DuPont. And she wanted to get into research, and so she chose DuPont because it had greater potential. During her interview with DuPont, Dr. Charch had said the company would reach out to her in about 2 weeks to tell her if she had gotten the job or not. Stephanie asked if they could possibly get back to her sooner than that, because she had to let another company know if she would take their offer or not.
Brilliant.
Charch then called in his receptionist to verbally write Stephanie's letter of offer in front of her on the spot. So while at DuPont, she joined a research team called the Pioneering Research Laboratory. This was only a few years after the same company and that team had developed the world's first synthetic fiber known as nylon. Still thinking that she would go into medical school, she was initially assigned to work on textile fibres, but she quickly distinguished herself through her intellect, creativity, and dedication. She enjoyed the work and the thrill of making discoveries, and she was fortunate enough to work under men who left her alone to do her thing. So she was able to work on her own experiments, which she loved, and said it appealed to her creative side. At DuPont, the polymer research she worked on was so interesting and challenging that she decided to drop her plans for medical school and make chemistry her lifetime career. In 1959, she won a publication award from the American Chemical Society, the first of many awards. The paper, which was titled The Nylon Rope Trick, demonstrated a way of producing nylon in a beaker at room temperature. It is still a common classroom experiment today. In 1965, there was a gas shortage, and DuPont gave their employees a challenge to look for the next high-performance fibre to take the place of steel wire in tyres. I didn't even know that tyres had steel wire in them, but there you go.
Yeah, I didn't either, but then you think of it, like if you see a burst tyre on the side of the road too, particularly truck tyres.
It's got fibres coming out of it. Yeah. DuPont thought that if the tyres were lighter, that this would ensure better fuel economy. So people would want to buy their tyres that they made because of the gas shortage. At the same time, the Second World War had emphasised the need for a lightweight, wearable armour to protect personnel and equipment. Steel was the only armour material available at the time, and its weight limited its use. Even then, steel could still be pierced by specialised weaponry. Stephanie was assigned to experiment with high-performance fibres to develop lightweight yet durable materials that would have applications in various industries. Now, we're going to get a little bit sciencey.
Oh, God.
Okay? I've tried to make it as simple as possible. There are a few words in here that I don't know what they mean. So while working on really long chains called extended polymers that had a lot of benzene rings in them, they were very difficult to dissolve. But Stephanie found a solvent that could dissolve them. So I'm guessing dissolve these benzene rings within the chain. Mm-hmm. She noticed that the solution that she was left with after this was dissolved was not your typical polymer solution, which was normally like syrup. This was lighter, thinner, and watery. Now, a little quick chemistry lesson. The process of turning solution into fibre is called spinning, where a solution is put through a spinneret. The solution is forced through tiny holes to create strands, then spins them, similar to how cotton candy is spun. The solution that she had discovered had unusually low viscosity, was opalescent, and was buttermilk in appearance. Conventional polymer solutions are usually clear or translucent and have the viscosity of molasses, more or less. The solution that she prepared looked like a dispersion that was totally filterable through a fine pore filter. What she had created was a liquid crystalline solution, but she did not know that at the time. This sort of solution was usually thrown away. Stephanie was denied the use of the spinneret for her solution because it was thought that the solution would clog the machine. The guy who was operating the spinneret commented that it was too watery and furthermore had particles in it that were going to clog his machine. He was mistakenly interpreting the opalesque as particles, but Stephanie was adamant that there was no particles in this solution, but still he refused.
He knows better.
Always know better. Mm. However, a few days later, she had persuaded him. He felt bad and he said, okay, then give it a go. Come on, little woman. Let's spin it. So the fibre that came out was very strong and very stiff, and she knew that she had made a groundbreaking discovery. She was amazed to find that the new fibre would not break when nylon typically would. Not only was it stronger than nylon, it was 5 times stronger than steel by weight. Both her supervisor and the laboratory director understood the significance of her discovery, and a new field of polymer chemistry quickly arose. During her studies, Stephanie also learned that the fibres could be made even stronger by heat treating them. The team were looking for something new and different, and Stephanie had discovered it. The discovery laid the foundation for the creation of Kevlar, a synthetic fibre renowned for its exceptional strength, heat resistance, and versatility. Now, I'll also mention that Stephanie was the only scientist currently working at DuPont without a PhD. So she did her whole career just with a bachelor degree.
Yeah, right.
So Stephanie's invention of Kevlar represented a paradigm shift in the realm of materials engineering. Unlike traditional fibres such as nylon and polyester, which relied on sheer thickness for strength, Kevlar derived its exceptional toughness from its molecular structure, composed of long, rigid chains of molecules arranged in a crystalline orientation. Kevlar possessed unparalleled tensile strength and stiffness, making it ideal for a myriad of applications. So Kevlar is used in more than 200 applications, including tennis rackets, skis, parachute lines, boats, airplanes, ropes, cables, and bulletproof vests.
Rouses.
It has also been used for car tires, firefighter boots, hockey sticks, cut-resistant gloves and armoured cars, as well as protective building materials like bomb-proof materials, hurricane-safe rooms and bridge reinforcements. But what Kevlar is most known for is its use in ballistic vests and stab-resistant body armour. This revolutionised law enforcement and military protection, saving countless lives around the world. So before 1971, there were no bulletproof vests or helmets. And bulletproof vests were simply not a thing, mm-hmm. and helmets were made out of steel. So think of, like, you know, those all those wars that happened before 1971, no one's wearing a bulletproof bulletproof vest or a helmet, and now any of the armed forces all get given this bulletproof vest and bulletproof helmets which is just extraordinary to learn, you know, 71. Mm. I mean, when you think of all the wars before that, and we're sending people in, just off you go, pop on this steel helmet.
Good luck to you.
And a shirt, and a canvas shirt.
Yes, yeah. And
off you go.
Yeah.
So Kevlar has gone on to save lives as a lightweight body armour for police and the military to convey messages across the ocean, as a protector of undersea optical fibre cable, to suspend bridges with super strong ropes, and to be used in countless more applications, from protective clothing for athletes and scientists to canoes, drumheads, and frying pans. So Stephanie's invention of Kevlar cemented her status as one of the most influential chemists of the 20th century. Her pioneering work not only transformed the field of materials science, but also had profound implications for society at large. The widespread adoption of Kevlar in diverse industries underscored its transformative potential and solidified Stephanie's legacy in innovation. Over her 40-year career at DuPont, she would file 28 patents. In addition to Kevlar, she contributed to products such as spandex, that we know as Lycra. Mm-hmm. So when you pop your leggings on, go for a walk, we can thank Stephanie. Nomex, which was actually the name given to Kevlar at first, and Kapton, which I'm not sure, K-A-P-T-O-N, not 100% sure what that is, but Google it. She continued as a consultant to DuPont after her retirement in 1986 and became the first woman to earn the company's Lavoisier Medal for Research in 1995. Now, one thing that we all know too well in these stories, she did not profit from DuPont's products as she signed over the Kevlar patent to the company. It makes me want to cry.
I know.
Her discovery generated several billion dollars of revenue for DuPont, but she never benefited directly financially. Beyond her scientific achievements, she inspired countless individuals, particularly women, to pursue careers in STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. In recognition of her contributions to science and engineering, she received numerous accolades and honours throughout her lifetime. These included the National Medal of Technology, the Perkin Medal, and in 1995, she became the fourth woman to be added to the National Inventors Hall of Fame. Now, just think about that for a second. 1995, the fourth woman. So there were only three other women in history until 1995. To be added to the National Inventors Hall of Fame. Now, we know, and our Chickstorians know, that there are many, 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 many more women than just three who invented things.
Mm-hmm.
Not good enough.
not society good enough. Pick up your game.
In 1986, Stephanie retired as a research associate for DuPont. Toward the end of her life, served on both the National Research Council and the National Academy of Sciences. Stephanie Kwolek died at the age of 90 on June 18, 2014. During the week of Stephanie's death, the 1 millionth bullet-resistant vest was made with Kevlar. And that is the story of Stephanie Louise Kwolek, whose pioneering work not only revolutionized industries, but also saved countless lives and inspired generations of women to become scientists. And looking back on her extraordinary career, Stephanie said, "I was fortunate enough to do something that was of benefit to mankind. I don't think there's anything quite like saving someone's life to bring satisfaction and happiness." Thanks for listening. We did it again.
We did.
We'll see you next week.
See you next week. Like, subscribe, tell your mates, follow us on the gram.
And we'll have a good week.
Have a great week. See you. Bye.
Bye.